So, lecture 22, April 7th. Lecture note page is 202, I think. So if you're looking for a little summer work, the Ambassador Crawford College of Business and Entrepreneurship Undergraduate Programs Office is hiring student assistants for the Destination Kent State for this summer. If you're interested, you can go to Handshake and sign up or whatever, apply for a position to assist with DKS over the summer. Last reminder, if anybody in the College of Business staff or faculty has gone above and beyond to help you out, you can submit them for a nomination for an award. Tomorrow is also the last day to register for the Ready for Business Boot Camp, where you'll have a morning of workshops and a excellent etiquette luncheon. So if you're interested in that, click away. I don't know if any of you guys know any of these guys or not. Ethan Cregan, Lauren Hollis, Jordan Hunt, Caitlin Phillips, Armis Shivana, Chris Boynt, or Angelique Wong. But these are all the finalists in the CB pitch. And if you know any of them or are interested in entrepreneurship, join in on April 21st from 4 to 6 p.m. for the 6th annual CB pitch. These guys will present their business ideas sort of like a, what am I trying to come up with here? Shark Tank. I'm getting too old to teach because I can't remember words. Shark Tank. Thank you. Sort of thing where they'll get, they'll compete for $20,000 in cash prizes. So if that strikes your fancy, sign up for that. Extra credit number 8 closes tonight at 11:59 p.m. Mini test 11 of 13. Yes, there's 13 altogether. 11, 12, 13 still to go. Opens tomorrow on its regular schedule, and midterm 2 is up, running, and so far people are taking it, so everything seems okay with that. It closes next Wednesday, turns off at 5 p.m. Questions on that? Someone asked me when the final opens. Getting ahead of things a little bit. Final opens May 5th, and runs, I think, till like May 10th or so. So that's for later. Yep. You have to be a little louder. Finals go across 2 weeks. Is that what you're asking me? Yeah, they break across that, as I recall. Yeah. Yeah. No, the finals will run the same way as midterm 1 and midterm 2 online over a 5-day period at your leisure from your site. It's convenient. Other questions? So there we are on the calendar. Things opening and closing. Midterm 2 we know about, covers mini tests 6 to 10, the associated lecture notes and textbook pages. We know about that, so enhanced learning, extra credit, and backpack number 8 close tonight, and the next one, 9 of 10, open on Friday on the regular schedule. We know that. Okay, so this was, I thought, a cute idea. Cracker Jacks now has Cracker Joe joining in to celebrate women in sports. This goes to, once again, I'm finding things that are going to the UN sustainability, social responsibility stuff. Goal number 5, gender equality. Baseball's 7th inning stretch is getting a new look and sound this year as the longtime snack associated with the tradition, Cracker Jack, gets a team of new mascots to be known as Cracker Joe. New packaging introduction, brand image, management, social responsibility, marketing, the UN Goal 5 gender equality. Cracker Jill will make her debut today, Major League Baseball's opening day, although the Guardians don't open until the 5th, yeah, like the 15th, I think, and celebrate women who break down barriers in sports, says Tina Mahal, VP of Marketing at Frito-Lay North America, Cracker Jack's parent brand. So brand positioning, 5 new packages of Cracker Jill will be available at Major League ballparks and direct to consumers online, where purchases will support the Women's Sports Foundation. Frito-Lay's intention is to make Cracker Jack a part of the brand ethos going forward, sharing package fronts with Cracker Jack and Bingo the dog, who will appear with both Jack and Jill. The introduction continues a trend towards representation and social justice exhibited by brands since the George Floyd murder of 2020. Mars Wrigley's M&Ms, for example, captured widespread attention and for a creative reset of its candy characters driven by a new message around inclusion. So here's the impact of one of those CREST factors. We haven't said CREST in a while per se. Competition, regulation, legal and political, economic, social trends, and technology on marketing. So changing social norms on marketing. Frito-Lay, parent company Pepsi, is among the CPG, consumer packaged goods, giants leading such multicultural and inclusion efforts as it scales efforts begun by its beverage division across its North American portfolio under Derek Luce, who's heading up a new multicultural business practice at the company. Frito-Lay's campaign includes a new recording of the classic Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Who are baseball fans? One baseball fan. I got to find out what some. I'm going to run a survey and find out what you guys are interested in. As far as I can tell, nothing. All right, so at the, say again.
For spring, it's lacrosse.
Lacrosse fans. We got one more lacrosse fan than we do baseball fans. All right. Anyhow, seventh inning stretch. Take me out to the ball game. Right. They've redone this by award-winning artist Normani. How many people know Normani? A few more know her. This person. Award-winning, that reimagines the iconic song, updating the lyrics to include Cracker Jill and to celebrate women's rights and girls in sports. A bit of celebrity in marketing.
No female had ever won a wrestling state championship in North Carolina until now.
An 11-year-old girl is the first girl in the history of the Arlington Football Association to score a touchdown.
Historic news in the sports world. The first female minor league manager in baseball history.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jill. No one can stop you if you have the will. So let's root, root, root for a girl's dream. We're adding our face to the game. And we'll run, throw with never a doubt. It's a new ball.
Play ball. All right, so that's the new idea with Normani. Campaign materials for launch were led by women and underrepresented creatives, led by creative director Ro Haber, the noted transgender writer and director. So we see a bit of authenticity in the marketing. Thank goodness they didn't get a bunch of old fat white men to develop this campaign. Not a good idea, not a good look. This is authentic. The Cracker Jill campaign will be supported with earned and paid media and placements in social channels like YouTube. Normani will also support the launch on her social channels, so the importance of digital marketing to business. Consumers can receive Cracker Jill at a new website where a $5 donation will support the Women's Sports Foundation. Frito-Lay's is making a $200,000 contribution, so you can donate at the website. This is their new look. You can see all the Cracker Jill characters. You can see the song we just saw played and find out more about what's going on at their website. So they're making a $200,000 contribution to Women's Sports Foundation. It's a national nonprofit that conducts research and advocacy and supports community programming to help girls and women across the country reach their potential in sport and life, so supporting gender equality. Our foundation is an ally, advocate, and catalyst to help unlock the possibilities in every girl and woman through the power of sport. Representation matters. It encourages and inspires the next generation. It's wonderful to see Cracker Jill come to life, emphasizing the power that representation can have by celebrating women who've broken barriers. Nice job. Chipotle. Their latest Roblox experience includes 100,000 free real-life entrees. I'm still too old to get my mind wrapped around why people want NFTs. People are earning rewards to get something that's purely digital and has no real, but a free entree, hey, sign me up. It's a real thing. Chipotle Mexican Grill announced a new metaverse gaming experience on Roblox that includes the chance to win free food in the real world. So sales promotion is what this is. Consumer experiences, the metaverse and marketing, we're going to hear more and more about that as the years come up. So the Chipotle Burrito Builder will allow players to assemble burritos in exchange for Burrito Box, Chipotle's inexperienced currency on Roblox. The first 100,000 players to build a burrito will earn Burrito Box that can be exchanged for free entrees on the Chipotle app or website. The experience launches today in celebration of National Burrito Day. So if you were to jump out to it, there you could be on the Roblox site building a burrito. The Roblox experiences have allowed Chipotle to better engage with customers, according to Chris Brandt, the chief marketing officer. We've tapped into play to earn an emerging engagement model in the metaverse. So we're adapting to changing technology. We're building consumer relationships. Also today, Chipotle is introducing its first menu item inspired by the metaverse, the Chipotle Burrito Builder Burrito. The burrito is based on a Twitter poll of Roblox's players' go-to burrito orders. It includes white rice, black beans, chicken, fresh tomato salsa, tomato red chili salsa, sour cream, cheese, lettuce, and guacamole. Chipotle called it the first real-world food created by a national restaurant brand in collaboration with the metaverse community. We used to call that crowdsourcing. Now it's the metaverse community. Okay. So, a new product introduction and connecting to the brand community. Several other brands are trying to engage with Gen Z consumers through creative gameplay experiences on Roblox. In November, Nike teamed up with Roblox to create Nike Land, a metaverse that would inspire a world inspired by the brand's Beaverton, Ohio headquarters, where players could play a variety of mini games and earn virtual rewards. Last month, it introduced Airtopia, an area within Nike Land, to promote Air Max sneakers. In September, Hyundai launched a virtual test drive experience called Hyundai Mobility Adventures. So, the future of the metaverse and your brand coming at you. And finally, anybody know the brand Ruggable for any reason? Ruggable? Okay, so if you have an apartment or a house and you've got a high wear area, you're sloppy, you got pets, you got kids, you just want something plush under your feet, you can get a Ruggable. A Ruggable is a two-part rug system. The bottom part is a cushion that also keeps the top part in place. The top part is a almost blanket-like rug, but highly rated online, that can come in traditional styles, that can come in plush, fluffy styles. And it's been successful, but now they're looking to reach a wider audience. So that's what the Ruggable concept is. Why Ruggable is going all in? Oh yeah, I'm out of my element here again. How many people know Bachelor Nation? How many of y'all, I finally found something, at least the ladies are, how many of you are following Bachelor Nation? Okay, we know about it, only a couple of us following it. Maybe you've already seen what I'm about to talk about then. All's fair in love and war and influencer marketing, said every former Bachelor and Bachelorette contestant, probably. So influencer marketing, the Bachelor franchise is basically an influencer marketing factory. Regular people go on its reality shows and leave with thousands, and in some cases millions, more followers than they had before their audition process began. Many, many of them quit their jobs to pursue influencing full-time. According to Ruggable's CMO Linda Lay, they don't all suck at it. They have such a unique command across social channels and traditional TV. You end up also falling in love with them, quite literally. It's such an emotional connection. You have opinions about them, and you're rooting for certain people, and you hate other people, she explained, adding that with dozens of new contestants on each season, not to mention multiple seasons per year, the franchise can churn out influencers at a uniquely high volume. So again, influencer marketing. Do you have a favorite one that you follow? Couple, you like a couple? You like them all, okay. That's partly why the rug company, Ruggable, decided to exclusively tap former Bachelorette contestants for a recent influencer campaign that, according to the Ruggable team, drove a ton of buzz for the brand. In fact, Lay told us, Bachelor franchise influencers often have some of the best performing posts for Ruggable. So we're seeing social media influencers and marketing. Last month, 14 former Bachelorette contestants, such as Noah Erb on the right, and Justin Glaze, on the left, posed for pictures alongside the brand's new line of shag carpets. I thought shag carpets died in the 60s, but they're still around. They're plush, and the guys are sitting on them, making jokes about their embracing their softer sides with the campaign hashtag softer side, of course, in the captions. For this campaign, like I said, Rugged Bowl nearly doubled its engagement rate goal, garnering more than 100,000 total likes and comments on the influencers' Instagram posts. So it's working for them, and it's making use of social media marketing. Though Rugged Bowl's audience is primarily women, why would they want to focus on primarily women for this product? Well, the obvious one. In many, many cases in households, it's the woman who has to do with the redecorating, the redoing, the getting a carpet down, etc. So that would be your main audience, not exclusively, but still. The team decided to work with, though the Rugged Bowl's audience is primarily women, the team decided to work with men who could show off their softer sides and other body parts, I guess. Subverting masculine ideals in a playful way, noting that Bachelor Nation has a mostly female audience, so understanding our target consumer. Koch added that many Bachelor fans follow multiple former contestants on Instagram. Following multiple contestants on Instagram, I was just pointing to you because you are a fan. So many users would like to see, many users would likely see several of these posts. We wanted to drive buzz. We wanted to get people talking about it. And we saw that. So we thought that it was a huge win, says Dimitri Scherner, Rugged Bowl's Associate Director of Influencer and Partnerships. So apparently I should start tuning into Bachelor Nation and seeing what's going on in marketing. All right, we pick up with lecture notes, page 202, page 368 of the textbook, chapter 14, arriving at the final price. And I think we just start that lecture right, or that topic right now. I don't suppose you actually saw any of these guys advertising Rugged Bowls, did you? Okay, just curious. All right, so arriving at the final price, chapter 14. So there are six steps in setting price: identifying pricing objectives and constraints, estimating demand and revenue, and determining cost, value, and profit relationships. And we just did those in the last couple of lectures, yeah? Look, obviously vaguely familiar as topics. So now we're going to talk about selecting an approximate price level, setting the list or quoted price, and making special adjustments to that list or quoted price. So this example, talking about the possible range of prices, where's my storytelling chair? I borrowed from a sort of an old case that I used to use with the MBAs a long time ago, but it's sort of an interesting idea from a case of how a brand thinks about setting a possible range of prices. This was based on, anybody here today from construction management or whatever we call that major? So it is construction management. So I don't know if you actually know what I'm talking about or not. I don't know what they cover in your coursework, but this is the idea of pile drivers. So you know what a pile driver is? So if you're going to build a building in a soft land area where the earth isn't very hard, stable, rock solid foundation, you drive massive metal piles, stakes, into the ground. Boom, 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 boom. And to protect the piles from disintegrating, you had pads. So these pads, originally, when I first did the case, they were made out of asbestos. That's, as we know, not a good look, not a good way to go. But from the construction viewpoint, from this construction manager's viewpoint, they weren't very expensive. So you put in these not very expensive pads, bang, 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 but they didn't last very long. Now, if you're in the business, you don't actually usually own the equipment. The pile driver usually rent it on a daily basis, so it's not cheap to do that. And you have the crew that comes with the pile driving thing. Now, the problem with this approach, other than asbestos, of course, killing people, was you had to constantly stop, pull the pile driver back up, back it away, take out the old pads, put in the new pads, and start pile driving once again. So a company comes up with a new pad. Do I have it there? I guess that's the new pad. It was patented. It was wrapped in something so you couldn't see what the construction was. And it would last way longer than would the powder, the asbestos pads. The question now becomes, what can this new company charge a construction site manager, as it were, for the new pads? Now, the new pads were not very expensive. until you step back and realize how much it costs you to constantly have to back out the pile drive, pull away the pile driver, sit, stand around, pull the stuff out, put the pile driver back. So at the maximum, if you could actually explain to a construction manager how much that cost them on the job, you can charge the total value. The problem was that was a massively large figure when you started explaining all the numbers about moving the pile driver around, etc. So most people were not going to take that much sticker shock. That was too big an amount, even though technically they were saving that money. On the low end, of course, the absolute minimum you can charge for anything is the cost to make it. We often say what you want to do at least is cover your variable costs and contribute to the fixed costs, my salary from last time. So you can't sell it for less than the variable cost. So the minimum is the variable cost, and the maximum is that total value to the customer if you can convince them, get them to believe it, understand what the thing is truly worth. And then the case goes on to lay out the numbers and talk about the plausible pricing for this example. But in general, we would say that the possible range of prices is from the absolute minimum, what it costs you to make it, up to the complete value to the customer, which you sometimes have problems communicating. So let's think about how we might set our prices, what some approaches are. One approach is called price skimming. What we're going to do here is set the highest possible initial price that consumers who really, really want the product are willing to pay. So you have to understand the product and those consumers. What types of consumers are willing to pay a lot of money early on? People that we call innovators, exactly right. So we typically will see this when we are introducing a new product, we're the only ones out there, it's exciting and new, or innovative product. So we see it in the early stages of the product life cycle. And the people that typically will spend those dollars, that $20,000 for that flat screen TV I keep talking about, there are people that do that because they want to be the first on the block, talk about it in the office. They're techies. So price skimming, we set the prices high relative to our costs. Here we take note of something we talked about before and heard about in a video, this idea of the cost curve. What happens to the per unit cost as you produce more and more units over time? That per unit cost goes down. You get economies of scale, you've gone down the learning curve, you have less waste, less errors. So that's what I'm showing here with that cost curve dropping down over time. But we're going to set our price high relative to our cost. Now, costs do go down over time with longer production runs and more experience, and so you might keep that price high relative to your cost curve. And we create significant profits as we do drop our price down in steps over time, as long as we can sustain it, as long as people are willing to spend that money. So we can use this to rapidly cover investments in developing a new product. You remember from our product life cycle discussion, in the early stages of the product life cycle, when you're developing products, you're making no money, you're losing money. Even in the early stages of introduction, before you actually get the thing fully advertised and fully accepted by channels of distribution and people buying it, you're losing money. So it'd be nice if you could have a strategy that would allow you to recover your investments developing that new product early. It works because those innovators want that product, and because it's new, it's innovative, there are no competitors yet. So there's nobody out there charging a lower price. You have the exclusive deal. And we have a protection on the product, a copyright, a patent, a unique process that's hard to duplicate. So as a result, there are no easy substitutes, and we have what we just talked about last time, an inelastic demand curve. What are some advantages here? Well, it allows us to recover our development costs quickly. And by the way, if the market perceives your initial price as being too high, what can you do? You can easily lower it down. Let me say the market's not quite as excited when you go in and you say, oops, it's not really $5.99, it's $7.99. I was only kidding on the $5.99. They're not quite as excited about that. In the initial Apple iPhone, Apple quickly dropped the price of its original iPhones from $5.99 to $3.99. because initial sales were less than expected. In the marketplace, who was happy about that? new consumers. Who was not happy about that? People who just bought it and paid $5.99. Apple was no fool, of course. They offered up special coupons, special deals for those people that paid full price where they could get reduced price or, I forget what it was, free products. They're not foolish. But when things don't work out, you have somewhere to go. You can drop your price down. The major disadvantage is that if it really works well, you've got a fat profit margin. What have we said about competition in general? If they see you're doing great, they want a piece of that action. Not only are you doing great, you're making fat money. They want in. So you're actually encouraging competition to come in because of the fat profit margin. So a different approach is to use penetration pricing as a strategy. Here, what you're going to do is by plan set a low initial price on that new product that you have out there. And so what you're hoping to do is to appeal immediately to the mass market. Whoa, that new thing only costs that much? Get me some of that. So if it goes to plan, you will capture a large share of that mass market immediately, because it's a good deal. So we would use this when? Well, there's very few barriers to competition. Anybody can jump in, so we want to make it as hard as possible for them to jump in. And when we expect the product life cycle to be pretty long. Why? If it's real short and we're only making a teeny bit of profit, we're in and out, we didn't make enough money to make it worthwhile. So you have to expect a reasonably long product life cycle. Also, logically, we have to expect the demand to be elastic, so there will be a good response to our lower price. Lower price, bigger demand, because it's elastic. Otherwise, you're just giving away money. All right, so here's for the visual learners. Here's our cost curve. What's going to happen to our cost per unit over time as we have more and more production? It's going to drop down. And what do we do with our price relative to that? We keep it low. So we have a little profit margin during that whole run, but and we drop our prices as costs go down. So this small margin is likely to discourage competition. Wow, he's not making much on that. I don't know if I want to bother with it. And we're going to get a large share of the market quickly. Our volume is larger and our production costs per unit should drop more quickly. So a competitor coming in late probably is going to have higher costs than we have and probably can't charge a whole lot for it because we aren't. And with high volume over time, we still generate a reasonably good profit overall, even though our margin is small. So it's a different strategy. It's risky, though. We have to be able to do a really good job of forecasting the demand because we've got to gear up fast, order supplies, order raw materials, gear up our production, have inventory, have warehouses in place. And if it doesn't work out, we're screwed. So our production costs are going to stay high. We don't make a profit. So we have to be a little careful with that. But it is another approach. Another demand-oriented pricing approach is called slide down the demand curve. So here what we're going to do is we're going to start with a price skimming approach, and then we'll reduce our price as our costs decline. So what we'll do is appeal to a wider market, $20,000 TV, $20,000 TV, $20,000 TV, and then once those premium buyers are gone, we then begin to drop down. Or we begin to react to an influx of competitors who are now in on the good stuff we're doing. Visually, we skim, right? Relative high price to our costs, and then we begin to drop it down. So we get a good profit initially, get back those development costs, and then we reduce our price as the premium market, the innovators are satisfied, competition begins to enter. So that works out for us pretty nicely. So we can early recover our development costs. And as we drop our price, and our cost should be lower than new entrants because of the learning curve we keep talking about, it should discourage competition. They're getting in, and all of a sudden we've dropped our prices. Well, wait a minute. Our costs are too high. How's it going to work for us? And again, it assumes a reasonably long product life cycle to make this work well. On the other hand, it's a little hard to know just when to begin dropping prices. What happens if you drop your prices too soon? You're giving up profits you could have had. And what happens if you drop your prices too late? Now you've let competition in. So you got to have heads up, eyes up on this approach. We good? I see note taking. Yeah. Another demand-oriented pricing approach is prestige pricing. This involves setting a high price to attract quality or status-conscious consumers. That's the goal. This should appeal to the high-end consumers, and at the same time, it's going to limit its appeal to others who can't afford it. And that by itself enhances the product's image among those people for whom prestige is a big deal. Status is a big deal. So it looks a little bit like that. Costs go down over time. We just go ahead and charge high price, high price, high price, high price, high price. And people are willing to pay it. So the notion here is expensive is good. So Emporio Armani, Rolex, BMW, Bugatti, Prada might be brands which use a prestige price approach. Now, because of the high price, think Bugatti, or think, what am I trying to think of?
Rolex.
We're unlikely to sell in large volumes. But that's okay, because we make a significant profit with the large markup on each item that we sell. So it's a good trade-off for us. Okay, price lining involves setting, let me just check something here. Yeah. Just involves setting the price of a line of products at a number of different specific pricing points. This goes back to the example we talked about previously when we talked about Yoplait yogurt. They have different styles, different types of yogurt. They don't want to charge 69 cents for everything. They're probably cost issues. But even at that, they want there to be a perception of there being differences in their product lines. Even if customers don't know much about your products, they may perceive there to be a difference in quality based on the price alone. What do we really know about the difference between Yoplait 100 and Yoplait Greek yogurt? Do we really know what the difference is? But they're priced different. If the differences in the product lines and the models are not readily apparent or not easily viewed, then price lining, good, better, best, helps the consumer recognize that there are differences out there as long as those differences are noticeably different to the consumer. If they aren't noticed to be different, they all look the same. The consumer just buys the cheapest one. That's not what we hope for. So this is done fairly often. This is taken from fairly recent Mitsubishi's LCD projectors. So their good projector is the HC4000. Manufacturer suggested retail price, $1,995. At that price, the HC4000 makes high definition 1080p home theater experience affordable. Well, that depends on your opinion about what's affordable. With a 4,000:1 contrast ratio and dynamic iris control, the HC4000 provides crystal clear and finely defined imaging in racing scenes or film noir. With flexible HD connectivity, the HC4000 offers both HDMI and DVI for the true HD experience. But wait, there's more. How about Mitsubishi's HC7800D at a mere $39.99. This projector offers a high-precision conversion, original 3D glasses, high-speed liquid crystal shutter, delivering amazing performance, etc., etc. Good, better, and best, and you can't do much better than this, ladies and gentlemen. How about the Mitsubishi's HC9000D at a mere $6,995? Brings 10p active shutter 3D into your home, but that's not its only attraction at $69.95. It also offers great 2D pictures that place it among the ranks of the finest 1080p home theater projections available for under $10,000. Complete with all of the bells and whistles you might expect from a premium projector, the HC9000D has something for everyone. Just looking at them, it's a little hard to tell what the differences are. Now, they have different features, of course, which you would know in research, but also the price points pretty much tell you there must be differences, good, better, best. And who wants to settle for good? Good. I mean, you ought to have, at least have better, right? So, and of course, we note that all these end in odd numbers, nines or fives, which we will, I mentioned before, talk about a little bit later. Intel in the B2B world switched to a good, better, best policy to try to reduce complexity in the minds of consumers. For PCs, think of Celeron as being good, Pentium as being better, and Core as being best. Under the Core brand, the i3 represents the entry level of the Core family, with the Core i5 and Core i7 representing the mid-level and high-level products. Celeron will stick around for entry-level computing, Pentium for basic computing, and Atom for devices such as netbooks and smartphones. Good, better, best in the B2B world. So, what are some advantages of price lining? In some cases, depending what you're manufacturing, it doesn't cost you that much more to go on your side from good to better and better to best. So, what you may be able to do is for a fairly small cost investment, bump that price up. Good? Oh, better. Wow, best. So, it may increase your profits if the cost of adding those additional features are not that significant. And consumers tend to buy up, some consumers, you have to know your audience, buy up to a higher price, more feature-rich model, which is also then more profitable for the marketer. As a personal aside, I like to share with you the truth that I like Kohl's, I like the discount stuff, I don't need to have the top expense stuff. But when I go to buy technology, I know every time I buy the good instead of the better or the best, about a year later I regret it. So in my mind's eye, I'm already going, that's the good, show me the better or the best. And whatever it costs them, I'm paying the extra for that next model up. A disadvantage to price lining is that by focusing too much on this price, managers may overlook issues of quality, which is important, or consumer buying trends. You're focused just on what's this price relative to my other product lines. You have to focus on other things too. And if you use it as a regular basis, it might limit your ability to meet competitors' prices. They know what you're doing, and so they tag products right in the middle of your product lines or just below your good or whatever it is. How are you going to react to that? You're sort of stuck with good, better, best. So you have to be aware of these limitations. Odd-even pricing, which we've referred to by now a couple times, involves setting prices a few dollars or a few cents under an even number. We often see prices ending in 5 or 7 or 9 for psychological reasons. What do people tend to do when they see those numbers? Consumers tend to round down. So $39.95, they tend not to say, well, it's almost 40 bucks. They tend to say, it's less than 40. It's 30-something. What people do. Now, I'm going to talk out of both sides of my educational mouth here. I'm going to say two things that contradict one another. On the one hand, they say it's not considered to be as effective today as it was in the past because consumers become smarter about price. And as I was explaining this, I saw one student going, what? No, it's almost 40. It's not 39. At the same time, we see it used a lot, as we just saw it on the Mitsubishi projector line. We see it in cars. Here's the Dave Tao price, $39.65, $44.65, $44.255, whatever. It's fairly common, still used today. Lower price products, here's our apartment microwaves, $99.99, $119.99, $59.99. It's only 50 bucks. Well, no, it's almost 60 bucks, but people still round it down. So we do see it quite a bit. Target pricing, a sophisticated approach, requires some thinking. We begin by doing a lot of research, seeing what's in the marketplace, seeing what the competition is, talking to consumers, and we ask ourselves through this research, what's the highest price that the ultimate consumer would be willing to pay for a product like this? Research. And then we work backward. We know what they're going to pay. So then we ask ourselves, well, what's the retailer have to earn? What's the wholesaler have to earn? What do we need to earn? What's then left for expenses to build the product? So working backward through the markups taken by retailers and wholesalers, we determine what price to, well, retailers, what price to charge wholesalers, and then we'll adjust the composition, the expenses, and the features of the product to achieve that target price to the consumer. So instead of starting with cost and working out to profit, we start at the price we're going to charge them that they'll pay and work back to how much we have to work with to build it. So target price minus those markups minus the profit we need is equal to our target costs to build the thing. Bundle pricing. This involves setting prices for two or more products as a single bundled price. Of course, that bundled price is going to be less expensive than buying the bundled product separately for the consumer. So for buyers, the overall cost of the purchase shows a savings compared to purchasing each product individually. And for marketers, this technique avoids having to make price adjustments on each product. If I want you to buy both of these from me, do I have to put it on sale to, you know, to get you focus on me, not to go to the competition? So here, overall cost of the bundle is reduced. I don't have to reduce prices on each of the products because people might wonder, how good is that if you can reduce the price on it? Also, then the marketer captures the sale of both products in the bundle. The example I'm going to give you here is video game and the game itself. So the video game system, you buy it one place, and then you go buy the game somewhere else. I could have had that sale. What if I just bundled it together so I don't lose you to the competition? So here is the Microsoft Xbox Series 1 terabyte console with Assassin's Creed Valhalla. Anybody play Assassin's Creed?
Used to.
Used to? Is any good?
My friend does.
Any good?
The newer ones aren't good.
Not as good, okay. But nonetheless, you can have it for a mere $534.98, some kind of savings off the list price. Yield management pricing. This involves an interesting technique where you're going to charge a different price for the same good or service to different people. What? How are you going to charge different people a different price for the same product or service? Seems sketchy to me. Anything come to mind where it actually occurs all the time in the real world for a fairly built big ticket item? Senior citizens. Oh, well, actually, they're different, though. They aren't the same. That's actually a good point. We'll get to it. Discount for being senior? Cars would be the example, right? You know full well, at least I think you know, that in most normal economies, you and I are not paying the same price for that car off the lot, right? We have different negotiation skills. So what we're going to try to do is to maximize revenue for a set amount of capacity at any given time. So passenger airline seats, you know there's a sweet spot for buying those tickets. Buy it too early, they're more expensive. Buy it too late, they're more expensive. A month or so in advance is sort of the sweet spot. Train tickets, hotel rooms, very, you know, the hotel room's the same. When you buy it, can make a difference. Rental cars, concert seats can cost different amounts for the same seats depending on when you buy them. So for this to work, there has to be a fixed amount of the resource available for sale. There's only so many hotel rooms, so many concert seats, so many airplane seats. And it works best when those resources are perishable. So there's a limited time that selling the resource makes any sense. Selling you a ticket, concert ticket today for a concert that happened yesterday, I can get you a really good deal on that. Are you interested? Not usually. The concert's done. Right? So it requires that these things be perishable, and it requires that different customers are willing to pay different prices for using the same amount of resources. Buying the same product, buying the same service is where this works best. One approach is airlines. Airlines often, though not always, charge more for people who book later. Why? Those folks are often business travelers. They can't plan vacations in advance. You know, they're planning for business. Things come up, and they're less sensitive to price than our regular consumers. Or our friends in the fashion industry, often they price the other way around. They charge less later in the season. Why? The item is moving out of fashion. The season is changing. Nobody's buying winter coats right now. We're going to charge less. Even though the product's the same, you bought a month ago, you pay more, now it's less. Let's switch to cost-oriented pricing approaches. One approach based on cost is standard markup. In this case, what we're going to do is add a usually standard fixed percentage to the cost of all items in a specific product class. Usually, this refers to setting the retail price. Anybody have any idea, like in a jewelry store, what the markup percentage on cost of jewelry is? Is it 10%, 50%? No? No reason to know. It's often 100% markup. Why? Jewelry does not turn over that fast. It's going to sit on the shelf for a long time. You can't afford to take a teeny, it's going to sit there a long time. So it might easily be 100% markup. Services can also use a fixed percentage markup. Sometimes, not as common, it's used to refer to the manufacturer setting their wholesale price, so the manufacturer knows what their costs were, and they take a fixed percentage to figure out the cost price for the wholesaler. So the retail price is equal to the cost plus this markup. This can be a little tricky if you're in a retail establishment, if you're new to it, to figure out what should your markup be. So let's take a look at that. Let's first think about calculating a percent markup based on the selling price. So we know there's some standard markup based on the selling price. What should ours be? So the markup on selling price as a percent is equal to the markup dollars. How many dollars you're going to mark this thing up, divided by the selling price times 100. Let's get rid of that percentage. Or if we want to think about it based on cost, then the markup on cost is a percentage equal to the markup dollars divided by the cost times 100 to get rid of the percent. All right? So let's look at an example. Markup based on cost. I'm a retailer. The cost to me is $36 for each product that I want to sell. And I know that the industry markup is 125% of cost. So how much should I charge for my product at retail? Well, markup on cost percent is equal to markup dollars divided by cost dollars times 100. But I don't know what the markup dollars are going to be. That's my problem. Well, let me see. I do know the markup on cost. And I do know what the cost is in dollars. So let's get rid of that percentage by multiplying both sides by 100. Or dividing both sides by 100. So divided both sides by 100, I now get markup on cost divided by 100 equals markup dollars divided by the cost, which is $36 times 100. So we're dividing both sides by 100. That gives me 1.25, or equal to the markup dollars divided by the $36 cost. So I'm going to multiply both sides by 36, So 1.25 times 36 is equal to markup dollars, and 1.25 times 36 is equal to $45. So what's my retail price? The retail price is the selling price, $36, plus 125% markup on cost, $45. So my retail selling price, if I want to get this industry markup of 125% of cost, $81. Okay. Accounts are going, that's no problem. Others are going, wait, what's the percent again? We good? Conceptually? Okay. All right, if we want to do markup on selling price, the cost of me is $36 again for each product I want to sell. I'm selling the product for $80. I want to know what is my markup on this selling price. I want to compare it to other industry standards. So the markup on selling price at percent is equal to markup on dollars divided by selling price times 100. So the selling price is 80, the cost of me is 36. The markup is 80 minus 36, or $44. So we now begin to see stuff that fit into our formula. So the markup on selling price as a percent is equal to $44, our markup, divided by $80, our selling price, times 100, or, we knew the arithmetic, 55%, based on selling price. I've heard stories of people who go to set their prices, they know what percentage they want to work with, and they lose whether they're trying to do it on the selling price or on the cost. That can mess you up pretty good in terms of getting your inventory out there. Another cost-oriented approach is cost plus pricing. Just as markup pricing arrives at a price by adding a certain percentage to the product's cost, cost plus pricing also adds something to the cost. Often, it's going to use a fixed monetary amount. So you talk to your home remodeler for that nice new kitchen you're going to put in, and he says to you, I'll tell you what, here's the way we're going to do it. I'm going to charge you whatever the cost is on these products we're going to put in, because you may want marble, you may want granite, you may, whatever that cost of these things are, plus $5,000, or whatever the number is. So they are going to have cost plus pricing, and it works in business B2B as well. But B2C, whatever the cost is, you choose what you want, you're going to pay for the cost and my money on top of it. All right, so usually it's going to be a fixed monetary amount. Sometimes we're going to add a fixed percent to the manufacturing cost, but that makes it look pretty much like our other example. Experience curve pricing is actually a cost-oriented pricing approach we've seen before under a different name, as you'll see in a second. It's based on that idea of the learning effect. That learning effect, which we've talked about several times by now, says the unit cost of many products and services declines by somewhere between 10% and 30% each time your firm doubles its experience of producing and selling it. The result is the possibility of rapid price reductions, which gives an advantage to those market leaders. So we actually saw that before when we talked about sliding down the demand curve. Let's switch our attention now to profit-oriented pricing. Who knew there was so much to pricing? One approach is to have target profit pricing. We have a certain amount of profit we like to make each year in dollars. So we try to figure out what we have to sell for to get to that annual profit. Or we might have a target return on sales. Here, we're going to set prices to achieve a profit. That's a specific percent of the units sold. Again, a little arithmetic to figure that out. Or we may have our investors in mind. Our investors, after all, could be putting their money somewhere else. So we get a target return on investment pricing. We set our prices to achieve a specific annual return on investment. Just between you and I, one of the problems with this approach in general is it sort of ignores the idea of demand. So sure, I'd like to make $1 billion in profit this year. I'll just set my prices at some exorbitant amount. Nobody's buying at that amount, so that's not going to work. You have to keep in mind the realities of your market, the realities of demand. Competition is out there, rearing their ugly face and trying to take over your consumers. So we might have them in mind as we set our prices. One approach is to use customary pricing. We're going to set our prices based on the traditional price in this channel of distribution or the traditional price in our market. So we just look to history, we see what competition is doing. Meh, that's what we'll charge. The opposite of having to do a lot of work. Or we can charge above, at, if it's at, it's pretty much like customary, or below the market. So here we use the competitor's price as a reference point, and we price above theirs, if there's some good reason to be able to do that, at theirs, or below their reference point. Now here's an interesting way to think about competition and setting your prices. Loss leader pricing. We'll set our price below its profitable price. I'm not sure how you make that up in volume, because the more you sell, the more you lose. When would you ever use loss leader pricing? When would that ever make sense? You're selling it for less so that you're not making a profit. When would that ever make sense? Yeah.
As a complement to something?
As a complement to something, in the sense that when you come in and get this one that's we're not making any profit on, you're buying it with that thing over there where we are making a pretty good profit, right? So as a complement to something. Did you have a different idea?
I was going to say maybe like if it were to like get rid of your inventory.
True. As that would be a way to get rid of stuff. It's not so much a pricing strategy as a desperation, but there you would be able to sell it as less than price. The goal here is not to make money on that item, but to attract the customer's attention in the hope that they'll buy other, more profitable products, like your example of being complimentary or something. Or, you ever seen the grocery store? They'll have, I don't know what a liter of Pepsi sells for. A liter of Pepsi sells for $1.89, but this week it's 99 cents. What are they hoping you're going to do? They aren't hoping that you're going to go in and buy 10 liters at 99 cents and go home. You'll go in and you'll buy some of those kumquat-flavored ding-dongs and some TV dinners and some chicken while you're there. So they draw you in, they get your attention with the loss leader, but the hopes are, of course, that you're going to buy other things while you're there. So, Costco's fans? Costco? Only a couple? Anybody like the rotisserie chicken in particular? No? So, Costco's rotisserie chickens are well known as a loss leader, defined as merchandise sold at a loss in order to draw in customers. In other words, Costco is willing to sell those chickens at $4.99, even if they're not making any money on them, because the chances are good that you're not making the trek to the warehouse store for a single chicken. Even if you think you're going to run in, grab a hot rotisserie chicken, and beeline it to the registers, how often do you really do that? You remember that you're almost out of laundry detergent, or you see a pair of designer jeans that you totally don't need but are so cheap you have to have them, or you get suckered into buying a 36-pack of sausages because the sample was that good. 9 times out of 10, you're leaving Costco with a whole lot more than a $4.99 rotisserie chicken and a whole lot less money in your wallet. Costco might be willing to sell you a delicious chicken for under $5, but they're certainly not doing it out of the goodness of their heart, although you could choose just to buy the chicken. All right, so the fifth step, having decided on your basic strategy, is to set the list or the quoted price. One approach is a fixed price policy. Everybody pays the same, fixed price. So at least in America, you don't go up to the local Acme register and start dickering over the price of the apples. You know, these over here, they're smaller and they don't look quite as good as those. I tell you what, I'll give you 5 cents less a pound. Nope, everybody pays the same thing. Fixed price. Also called a one-price policy. Obviously then, if you have a fixed price, you also could choose to have flexible price policy. This involves setting different prices for products and services depending on the individual buyers and the individual purchase situation. Negotiating skills. etc. Think our car example, where you have a flexible price policy. Also called dynamic pricing. Okay, so those are the two basic approaches, either fixed or flexible. So what sort of factors influence this list or quoted price? Well, one are the company effects. We suggested before, if you have a series of products and you want people to see them as good, better, best, well, then you've got to price them that way. So your product-like pricing can affect your quoted price. Consumer effects. Then we have the issue of what does our price convey to the consumer? Are we looking for a good bargain? Kohl's, Walmart, Costco? Are we looking for prestige? Prada, Saks. And competitive effects. What is the competition doing? We do not ever want to find ourselves in a situation where we get into a price war with the competition, where we need to cut our prices to increase or maintain our unit sales or market share against competition. So we cut our prices, and then they cut their prices under our prices, and then we cut our prices into their prices. Great for the consumer, not good for staying in business. So you have to keep in mind what the competition is going to be about. In the old days, before the pandemic, okay, when airline travel was a normal thing, occasionally you'd see a major airline try to raise prices on a particular route, and then sometimes nobody would follow them. They'd actually have to back their prices back down because none of the competition followed along with them. So you'd have to pay attention to the competition out there. Then we think about special adjustments to that list or quoted price. This is not going to make your price flexible. It's a special adjustment to your fixed price. For example, quantity discounts. We may offer reductions in unit costs for larger orders. The assumption is that we get economies of scale savings that we pass along, at least some of it, to our customers. Anybody ever work in a warehouse, by any chance, a warehouse? No? So if you work in some of these big warehouses, forget the Amazon, which are just crazy, but big warehouses, and you get an order, and the order is for a dozen pencils, well, the order comes in. We have to process the order. We have to give the order to you. You have to go trundle off and find a dozen pencils. You have to bring a dozen pencils back. I got to ship a dozen pencils. I got to run the paperwork to bill you a dozen pencils. I have to follow up on that. It's not very efficient. It's expensive. So I tell you what. Oh, and by the way, then a week later, you get another order for a dozen pencils from the same company. Tell you what I'm going to do. How about you order 30 dozen pencils, and I'll give you a discount, because it's going to cost me a lot less to send you out one time to pick up 30 dozen pencils, bill at once, ship at once, etc. So this is the idea of economies of scale. In non-cumulative quantity discounts, the price reduction is based on a single order. And that larger order, instead of buying one dozen, you buy 30 dozen, is expected to reduce our billing costs, our order filling costs, our shipping costs, our sales costs. Makes my life easier. I'm willing to pass on a little bit to you. Or another quantity discount approach is to use a cumulative quantity discount. Here, the price reduction is based on the total quantity purchased over some time period. In B2B, that could be a year, or it could be a quarter, certain number of purchases. The goal is to encourage the customers to return to us for the reorders. You ever get one of those little coupons from somewhere and you buy 10 and the 11th one is free or the 10th one is free? I used to have that. Maybe it was for Squirrels Coffee, when I used to buy from Squirrels, I think. And occasionally I'd say, well, I could go to Squirrels or I could go to Starbucks. I might as well go to Squirrels because pretty soon I get a free one. It actually drew me back in. So I get a little free discount and they kept me coming back to them. Businesses have much larger dollar amounts at stake. Seasonal discounts can be another way to adjust your list or quoted price. Here we're going to have reductions based on the time the purchase is made. That could be time of day, that could be a day of the week, it could be week, month of the year. So we're trying to reduce time variations, seasonal variations in sales. The travel industry often offers much lower off-season rates. So when do Florida hotels charge the higher prices? What's Florida's high season? Winter time, right? Summertime, it's really hot. Young people like to go there, but the big travel folks, it's too hot. We'll go north. So they will offer much lower off-season rates to bring people in. These can also be based on the day of the week or the time of the day. Early bird specials for senior citizens for those restaurants. They don't order that much. They take a long time to eat. Let's move them in front of the big crowd, give them a reduced price, get them in early, and then have our regular diners come in later in the day. Or for movie theaters, here's the weekend early bird special at the Oak Harbor Cinema. And so you get a deal if you come, whatever that says, whatever time of day it is. Oh, 10 a.m. or 10 a.m. on the weekend, you get a reduction. Come in early and find a combination you love for less. Early dinner duos, $8.99, whatever that is. So draw people in during the slow time. Trade or functional discounts from the list price. These are reduction list prices that we offer our distribution channel, our wholesalers, retailers, the rack jobbers, the people who actually put our stuff on the shelf, for performing some function for us in the future. So back to the example of how things could work. I'm a manufacturer of something. And I know that downstream, my retailers want these things in a few months. And they don't want an entire barrel of these things. They like them boxed together in smaller boxes. So I manufacture barrels. I'm the only guy doing the work, so now I get to put them in boxes. Now I got to store the boxes for some amount of time, so I need a warehouse. And you ship them to the warehouse. Now I got to ship them to the retailer, and I got to get them on the shelf. That seems like a lot of work. What if I can get somebody else to do some of that stuff for me? So we might give discounts to entities for doing some of these functions, such as warehousing, stocking the shelf. Trade discounts actually are often combined to include a series of functions for a channel member. For example, a 2012-5 series of discounts could indicate giving you, off of that list price, a 20% discount for warehousing the product. I don't want to build a warehouse, store it, keep track of it, take the risk of it. An additional 12% discount for shipping the product, off my hands, thank you. And an additional 5% discount for keeping our shelves stocked with our product. Thank you very much. So here's the 2012-5 example. The manufacturer suggested retail price at retail, hence retail price, is $200. We're going to award a channel member 20% for warehousing the product. So 20% of 200 is 40 bucks. So if it's the retailer doing the warehousing, they get a 40 buck profit. So that becomes the retailer's price. Now we're going to give a discount of 12% for shipping the product, and we're going to give that to the wholesaler. So they get $19.20 profit. So their cost is $140.80. And the rack jobber is going to get 5% for keeping our shelves stocked. So they get $7.04 off of that $200 manufacturer suggested retail price. So the jobber's cost in this whole process is the manufacturer's selling price of $133.76. And then, of course, the manufacturer is making some profit on that. So we're going to give these people trade discounts to take some of this load off. If you see the textbook, it's a series of channel members. They use a 30-10-5 example on page 96. 30% for the retailer, 10% for the wholesaler, 5% for the jobber. Same idea. Take the load off of me, reduce that list price. Cash is nice. I have to buy raw materials. I have to pay the people who work for me. I have inventory costs. And so I sell you $100,000 worth of product, which, by the way, I've had to pay for the raw materials, had to pay for people to make, and you're going to pay me in 30, 60, or 90 days till I get my $100,000. What am I doing for cash? What am I doing for cash? Finance people? See what? Well, I need the cash. I got to continue operating. I'm waiting for $100,000. What do I do as a business? Webbies? No. Yes, thank you. You said that? I want you to sit down here and tell me stuff. So, a loan, right? Is that loan free? Does mom just give me $100,000? She does not, nor does the bank. They're going to charge me interest. By the way, interest is going up. Tell you what I'm going to do. If you will give me cash, I'll reduce that $100,000 list price, because then I don't have to take a loan out at whatever percent it is. So cash discounts, or allowances, trade-in allowances, promotional allowances, so you get something on that car. For example, in the B2B world, on that machine you're turning back in. Or for a channel member, if you will advertise my product, wholesaler to the retailer, retailer to the public, I'll give you a certain amount of money off that list price as a promotion allowance. This gets complicated, the geographic adjustments, so I think we'll call it there. That will be the end of the material for mini test 11, which will open tomorrow. I may have mentioned that there's a midterm. Did I mention the midterm? Midterm 2 is running, so you ought to take that sometime. It's a good thing to do. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you next time. Bye.